see you. Thank you, brother.
The extended biography. The beginning of the movie The Jerk. I was born a poor black boy. Well, thank you very much, Pastor David, and thank you, Ecclesia, for having me. I always, despite my terrible opening, I always do take the invitation to share a pulpit very seriously, and I don't take it lightly. So thank you very much for having me. We have a fairly broad series of issues to address this weekend. So I want to begin just sort of with some introductions and just some thoughts off the top of my head, and then we're going to actually get specifically into Daniel 2. You know, it's been interesting. Over the past, I'd say 6 years, I've been traveling around a bit in such an incredible wide variety of churches. So many different cultures and subcultures throughout the nation and throughout the nations. And there's so many different approaches and attitudes toward the subject of the end times. And so it's interesting. You can come into one particular body and they might just be completely on fire for the issue, and others are real tentative and hesitant, and they're not really sure how they feel about this. They sense that something in the world right now is unhinged, that the world is becoming unhinged, but they're not quite sure how to relate to that, and there's a lot of different ideas floating around throughout the body, some of which completely reject the study of the end times, believing essentially that the overwhelming majority of the biblical prophecies that we would understand as speaking of the end times have actually all been fulfilled in 70 AD. That in 70 AD, the majority of the prophecies, or the burden of prophecies, have already come to pass. And so there's so many different issues that we could touch on. I just want to begin with the early church. You had, what was the brother that was just playing the guitar? What was his name? Jim. The fact that Jesus was the most revolutionary guy in the earth, this past year traveled. We were in Egypt about 2 weeks before the second revolution broke out. We were there when President Morsi and the Brotherhood was still in power. And just after we left, you had the largest protest in the history of mankind. Literally in the spot where we had just been with 30 million fiery Egyptians out in the streets demanding the overthrow of the present government for the second time in 2 years. I mean, this is unprecedented in history. And we were in Israel and the West Bank, and we were in Jordan, and then we were up in Turkey. We got caught in the middle of massive police crackdown on the protests that were taking place in Turkey. There had been for about 10 days before we got there. You plan these trips months ahead of time, you get your tickets, and about 10 days before you're on your way to Turkey, the news blows up that there's violent protests taking place right where you're going. And so you say to all the other guys, "Don't tell the wives, but we're excited." Like, right on. Don't act too excited. But so we showed up, and tomorrow I'll share all sorts of stories of some of these travels and some of the different things and the insights that have come out of that. But the night that we got there in Turkey, we went to it's called Taksim Square and the adjacent Gezi Park, right in the heart of Istanbul, and we essentially got caught in the night that just happened to be the most brutal government crackdown on the crowds. And, we got tear gassed and the whole nine yards, and we made it out relatively unscathed. And I've got some footage because we're filming a documentary. This is the reason we're in the Middle East. And so we've got some fantastic footage and some great, guy stories and so forth. But here's the point: is you've just had the Arab Spring. You've had what started out as a Tunisian fruit vendor selling fruit on the side of the road, who was harassed and shamed by some abusive government officials, and they took his fruit. This is literally where this whole thing began. And he was so upset and shamed that he poured gasoline on himself and he lit a match. And the revolution that began as a result of the actions of this one man swept the Middle East, with the end result of violent revolutions in over a dozen nations, with the overthrow of several governments. Okay, now this was a significant revolution. The problem with the revolutions, whether it's the Ukrainian revolution, whether it's the Egyptian revolution, any of these things, is very rarely do they truly accomplish the goals of the revolutionary. Sometimes revolutions can have long-term beneficial effects. Most often they don't. And the reason is because you have mankind that is attempting to effect change through politics and through natural means. And it's not to say that these things are unimportant or irrelevant, but hands down, the single most revolutionary people in the history of mankind were the early believers that were followers of the most revolutionary man. And in just a couple of very short generations, what began as 12 disciples and then grew into a movement turned the ancient world upside down and has forever changed this world unlike anything. And it was all through a message. It was through a message concerning a kingdom that was coming, a king that was coming, and the day of the Lord, there's a day of judgment whereby all of us will stand before the judge that will weigh the deeds of everyone, where the deeds done in darkness will be shouted from the rooftops. There's a day that we will all be held to account, and then after the judgment is the establishment of the kingdom of this Jewish man. And this message concerning this coming kingdom has transformed the lives of more than any other message, more people, you know, nothing has compared. But what was the thing that was driving them more than anything? It was the message that this Jesus that they saw crucified was coming back again, and he was going to judge the earth and establish his kingdom, and he was going to, you know, coming with the winnowing fork and separate the wheat from the chaff. He was going to throw the chaff into the fire that burns with unquenchable flames, right? And so here was the message of the early church. They thoroughly were focused on the return of Jesus and the establishment of his kingdom. Okay, this was what drove them. This was the issue that gave them the urgency, that caused them to lay down their lives with a courage that was incomparable, that transformed the ancient world and is continuing to do so to this day. Now, then gradually what happened was at that time you had the Hebrew world, you know, the Jews that were striving to follow the scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, and then you also had the overwhelming influence of the Greeks, sort of clashing the different philosophies. And one of the philosophies of the Greeks is essentially that, you know, the Bible begins with, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and they were good. So the heavens are good and the earth is good. They're both good. And essentially, when heaven dwells on earth, if you will, when God dwells with man, that's really the fullness of how the Creator made everything to work. And the Greeks, on the other hand, they sort of have this philosophy that says that the spiritual realm is good, but everything down here that's physical, that's on the earth, that's tangible, you know, that's materiality, that's bad. And so the real goal of the spiritual walk is to escape the shell of the flesh and to go become spirit forever in sort of this ethereal, celestial experience in the clouds. And so what happened is the Greek philosophical worldview starts essentially infecting and corrupting the Christian message, which was fixed on a very real kingdom. And of course, those who enter into the kingdom receive glorified physical, tangible bodies, you know, with physicality. Now, they're immortal, they're heavenly, they're eternal, but they're still very physical. They eat, we can touch, we can see all of these things. And this is in conflict with the Greek philosophical worldview. And so this Greek philosophical or this Gnostic worldview really came and it essentially dominated the church, to where this emphasis on the return of the Lord began to slowly become sidelined. And so you had the various Christian doctrines of what's called amillennialism. This is the idea that there is no millennial kingdom. There's no millennial period. You had the doctrines of preterism. That means biblical prophecy, all the Antichrist, the mark of the beast, the great tribulation. These things are all past. A lot of amillennials will say Jesus returns, he's coming back, but they strip all of the other events that precede his coming of any future relevance. And then you had replacement theology, which essentially says that God had made a promise to the Jews to give them the land that he would eventually fulfill when the Messiah comes back. And then replacement theology says, no, the Lord has divorced Israel. They're no longer the people of God. The church is the new Israel or the new people of God. And if Jews want to be the people of God, then they need to join us. And the promises that were made to Abraham are no longer in effect. And they'll just say things vaguely like, through the cross, the old covenant has been fulfilled. And they don't make a distinction between the Abrahamic or the Mosaic covenant. And there's an incredible amount of Old Testament illiteracy in the church. Well, the problem is these various doctrines, replacement theology, preterism, amillennialism, and we won't talk anymore about all these technical terms, they've come to dominate the majority of the church. And Christians rarely realize how much we're affected by all of these corrupt Greek philosophical doctrines. And that urgency and that expectation of the return of Jesus that would come back, that would establish justice in the earth, so much of that has been lost in the church today. Now enter modern times, the 1960s. You had Israel, against all odds, the modern miracle of the state of Israel reestablished. Now, of course, the amillennialists and the preterists and all, they would say, no, Israel's been divorced. He banished them, you know, the country was destroyed, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and that's never going to be restored. And the reason that they were so adamant about that is because it doesn't make sense if you say Jesus is not going to come back and establish a kingdom in Israel. It doesn't make sense if all the nations of the earth gather together against Jerusalem at the end of the age. Well, why are they gathering against Jerusalem? Why is Jesus coming back to Jerusalem? And why does everything center around Jerusalem? And they can't have that, so they go, no, 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 no. All those prophecies are in the past. Israel's never going to be reestablished. And then the problem is Israel is reestablished. You know, and it's kind of this glaring, gigantic briar in the side, the thorn in the side of those that deny all these things. And all these Christians start going, well, wait a minute. They start looking at the Bible and they're going, you mean this stuff's real? You mean the moral claims of the Bible actually are relevant for my... And they start looking at it and they go, this stuff is real. And suddenly there's the Jesus movement, what's called the Jesus movement, of the 60s and 70s, which is essentially the most significant revival in this nation in the past, you know, it's the most significant revival other than going all the way back to the turn of the century with the Azusa Street and the Pentecostal revivals and all this. So this is the big revival of the past 60 years is the Jesus movement. And then comes a book called The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. Everyone's reading this and they're going, oh my God, they're looking at the prophecies. And suddenly a measure of the eschatological urgency, eschatological just means the end of the age, the ultimate things, that urgency that the early church had is suddenly reawakened in the church, right? And again, people are getting saved left and right. Then what happens? Then comes a book called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Take Place in 1988. And I won't pick on the author. He's no longer with us. But the idea was, the idea was that Israel was established in 48, and then through a obvious misinterpretation of the verse that says that the generation that was alive to see those things would surely not pass away before all these things come to pass. And so the idea was that within 40 years, Jesus would return. So that when Israel reestablished in 48, 88, Jesus is going to return. Everyone, you know, the 80s are leading up to it. Everyone's excited. 88 comes, 89 comes, 90 comes, 91. I'm trying to think, what was some seminal event that happened at that time? Kurt Cobain killed himself. Everyone's just depressed, and they just, no, I'm just kidding. And he goes like, who's Kurt Cobain? What's that? The end of the Soviet Union. There you go. You know, but something a little more relevant. But the point is, here is one thing that did begin to take place, was the EU. The EU begins to be established. And so everyone kind of goes, this is that. And I remember I got saved in 91. So here I was, this 19-year-old kid, 1991, and I had no grid for any of this stuff. And, you know, most certainly never watched Christian television. Well, I turned on Jack Van Impe. And, you know, he's going on and you know, this and that. And but say anyway, I'm kind of running around. Here's the point, is what happened is a lot of people got hurt. During the 80s, 1988 came, a lot of people got burnt out, turned off, and they began to associate the whole prophecy culture with folks like Van Impe. And I'm not picking on Van Impe, but essentially the televangelist sort of culture and all of the problems that came with that in the 80s and the early 90s. And much of the church today is back in that place of cynicism. They kind of like, prophecy, been there, done that, tried that. It's a distraction. It's you know, it's ineffectual in terms of motivating believers to actually become engaged. Now, where most of the younger portion of the church is today is they're very much there. The last thing in the world they want to do is be associated with sort of a televangelist prophecy culture. And the main thing that the youth are focused on right now, and which is partially good, and there's also some excesses, but is they're emphasizing cultural engagement, justice ministries, the poor, human trafficking, the whole sex slave industry, working to free women from, you know, all of these issues, which is a good thing. We're called to engage culture. The problem is when you divorce the gospel from these things, it really just becomes humanism. You know, you're leading people out of bondage, out of Egypt, into the wilderness, and then just sort of leaving them there. If you don't give them the gospel, you're not bringing them into genuine freedom. It really just becomes humanism. And so, you know, the idea is that if you're into prophecy, you're not into engagement. Well, of course, as we've already seen, the early church was thoroughly prophecy-driven. Their emphasis was thoroughly on the return of Jesus. And they were absolutely the most engaged people in the history of the church. They were thoroughly engaged. And so biblical prophecy drove them to become engaged, to proclaim the gospel, to lay down their lives, all of these things. Okay, I'm just kind of rambling around. But the point is this, these things are relevant when they are applied properly, when they are applied in a biblically balanced way. They will motivate the church toward holiness, unto the day of the Lord, into the fear of the Lord. They'll motivate the church to be engaged with culture, yes, to be involved with the poor. Why do we minister to the poor? Because in the age to come, when the king establishes his kingdom, the poor will be cared for. We care for the poor now as we demonstrate the nature of the age to come. Why do we rescue people from slavery now? Is it because we're humanists and it's a good thing to do? It's just a good thing to do unto itself? Well, I mean, it's not a bad thing to do. No, we do it because we're demonstrating the nature of the kingdom that's coming, when all of the slaves are set free. And so we're actually proclaiming the gospel with our words and our deeds, but we can't neglect doing it with our words. This is important. A lot of Christian ministries out there that, you know, they say, it doesn't matter, you know, we'll join with Muslims, we'll join with anybody, you know, we'll join with anybody just because we're doing good deeds. That's sort of the end unto itself. But again, if you're doing that, you can have the veneer or the label of Christian, but you're really just a humanist. And again, humanism, it's better than being a Satanist. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say there. I mean, it's a good thing, but we have something that's far more eternal, that's far more substantive in it. It addresses the issues of the depravity of man. It addresses the deepest issues that mankind contends with. So, with all those things said, we're going to begin by looking at Daniel 2. We're going to delve into the scriptures. Now listen, tonight is very much just an informational study. Tomorrow will be a mixture of stories and testimonies and studies and so forth. Tonight is a bit, we're just sort of plowing the ground and digging into the scriptures. Now, I mentioned earlier the EU. What happened in the 80s was, as a lot of people were looking at the prophecies, there was this dominant idea that the Antichrist, his kingdom, and his religion would come out of Europe. This was, or out of the Roman Empire, I should say. Of course, the Roman Empire included much of the Middle East as well as North Africa. It included the majority of Europe, not all of it, but it was really a tri-continental empire. But then in the 80s, as the EU begins to be formed, everybody, all these Christians, these prophecy watchers go, this is that. The EU is that which the scriptures speak of. And so there was this sort of false equation that began to be cemented in the minds of people, which says this, Roman equals European. Okay, now that's partially true, but it's also partially wrong, right? Because Roman could be European or Middle Eastern or North African. But there was the idea that the Antichrist, his empire and his religion will come from Europe. Okay, and so this really became just sort of like sort of a neo-orthodoxy. You know, this is where he's coming from. Anyone that says anything other than that, even though Christians have been saying many other things, you know, that he would come out of the area of Syria from the early days of the church, that this was a widely held belief. And so the EU sprouts forward. Now, where did this European or Roman idea come from? It begins with Daniel chapter 2, and this is really the foundation of this whole debate. Does he come from Europe? Does he come from the Middle East? Where does the Antichrist come from? Why are we looking at these things? Because I believe that when we look at it, once again, we realize that what the scriptures speak of, as we look out in the earth, it makes sense. And once again, even as there was sort of that awakening in the 60s that said, Israel's back in the land, we look out at the nations and we go, these things really are lining up. This is not just someone sort of manipulating the data to try to make the Bible look relevant. It really is lining up, but the church has largely been distracted with this whole EU thing. So, Daniel 2, verse 32. This is the story, by the way, of Daniel. And he is a servant in the courts of King Nebuchadnezzar, who's the king of ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Babylon, that whole region. And Daniel was a Hebrew captive. Now the king, Nebuchadnezzar, had a dream. And he was very upset by the dream. And so he calls all of his magicians and his, you know, sorcerers and so forth. And he says, okay, guys, listen, here's the deal. I want you to tell me what my dream means. And they're like, okay, great, tell us the dream. And he goes, no. You tell me the dream, and then you tell me what it means. And they're like, you know, oh, this is a hard thing, you know. And they're like, you know, our magic is only so good. So they say, but there's this Hebrew, this guy named Daniel, that's amazingly profound with regard to these things. So why don't we go get him, you know? And if he fails, they'll behead him rather than us. And so they go and they get Daniel and they call him forward. And Daniel says, okay, well, listen, give me a night to sleep on it, which he does. And then, of course, the Lord reveals, the God of heaven and earth, the creator of heaven and earth, reveals the dream to Daniel. So now he's standing before King Nebuchadnezzar, and this is where we pick up. He says, Daniel says, you, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue, and that statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue is made of fine gold. So it's this massive metallic statue. The head is made of fine gold. Its breast and its arms are made of silver. Its belly and its thighs of bronze. And then it has legs of iron. We've got four components so far. And then fifthly, its feet, partly of iron, partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without human hands, some translations say, without human hands. So a stone is cut out through some supernatural means, and then it strikes the statue specifically on the feet of iron and clay, and it crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, so beginning from the feet and essentially working up, were crushed all at the same time. And they became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. So this is a complete, absolute, utter destruction of all of the elements of the statue. On the other hand, the stone that struck the statue becomes a great mountain, and it fills the whole earth. Now, in biblical symbolism, a mountain represents a kingdom. This is consistent throughout the prophets. Mountains are symbolic of kingdoms. And so this great mountain comes to fill the whole earth. Now, and then Daniel goes on to explain. He says, "You, O king, are the head of gold. After you will come another kingdom." So Daniel explains that the various elements of the statue are the head of gold is the Babylonian Empire. The belly, the chest and the arms of silver are the empire that would succeed his. That's the Medo-Persian. So here are the four empires that the predominant position throughout Christian history has been that the dream portrays these four: the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, and then finally the Roman Empire. Okay, this has been the majority position. I want to challenge the fourth kingdom, the idea that the fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire. I want to challenge that. And by the way, my means of doing that is I simply want to look at the scriptural criteria. What does the scripture say about, because it never names the fourth kingdom. You know, we all just go, yeah, it's the Roman Empire because the subheading in our Bible says so. You know, like they put it in there, it says the Roman Empire. We go, yeah, it's the Roman Empire. But the scriptures never actually say that. The scriptures name all of the other empires. It never names it just calls it the fourth empire. So the point that we want to do, we want to look at the scripture and say, what do the scriptures say with regard to the fourth empire? Does the Roman Empire fulfill that criteria based on what we know of history? And if not, are there any other empires that do? And as we see, as we will see, I believe that there clearly is. So Daniel 2, 37 through 40. There's Daniel. He says, "You, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And then after you shall arise another kingdom. And then another, a third kingdom comes after you." So the context of the dream is this. He says the dream was given to Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel's explaining the dream to King Nebuchadnezzar. He says, listen, this statue are about the kingdoms that will succeed yours. That will come after the Babylonian kingdom. After you will come another kingdom. And then another kingdom will come after that one. And so we need to recognize that the context is very Babylon-centric, if you will. It was pertaining to those kingdoms that would succeed the Babylonian kingdom. And then the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now, the first thing that we want to do is look at the nature of the rise of the fourth kingdom. And this is the first really critical criterion that we want to examine. Daniel 2 verse 40 says this, "The fourth kingdom will be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others." So the first thing that we know is that this fourth kingdom will crush all the others. What are all the others? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. What kingdom crushed Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece? Did the Roman Empire crush Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece? Some would say yes. Some would say no. So first, what we've done is we begin with a map, and I've put a dot there on the city of Babylon, and then a circle and several hundred miles from that epicenter of the context of the dream. Now that area in blue is the ancient Babylonian Empire. Okay, this was the region that Nebuchadnezzar ruled. Okay, and so then we say, did the Medo-Persian Empire come and crush that empire? And yes, it did. It succeeded his. We know, and in fact, the scriptures actually mention the Medo-Persian Empire. The three dots there are Susa, Ecbatana, and Persepolis. Those were the three capitals. Then came the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great sweeps across the... we got a dot. So he begins over here, and he sweeps across the whole Middle East, conquering the Persian Empire. And if you look at the two, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, very similar. and it clearly succeeded King Nebuchadnezzar. And so from King Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, he goes, okay, one just conquered mine, then comes another. Okay, then comes the Roman Empire. Now what happens? Suddenly everything shifts west, dramatically west. Now there is a degree of overlap for sure. You go back, okay, again here's, Now there's the heartland. There's, you know, this, the, here's the heartland. We skip forward. We go to the Roman Empire. And now, for clarity, the Roman Empire, when you look at a lot of maps, they'll say this is the Roman Empire at the time of its greatest extent. So here is the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, Babylon basically right here. Some of the maps will include the Roman Empire will come all the way down here to the Persian Gulf. That little finger they'll include in the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire did conquer that area for a few months in AD 116 under Emperor Trajan. He came down the Euphrates, and he did conquer what was the ruins of Babylon at the time. And then he had a sunstroke, is what most historians believed. He withdrew. Hadrian was his general at the time, forever declared that the easternmost extent of the Roman Empire would be the Euphrates. So right here, this whole area up here was forfeited. And so the Roman Empire, throughout the overwhelming 1,500 years of its existence, its easternmost border was pretty much hugging the Mediterranean coast here and then sort of kicking up into Asia Minor. That's modern-day Turkey right there. And this whole area, Armenia, and then the area that they did take for a few months, when they did take the ancient city of Babylon, was forfeited, and they moved it back here. So for clarity, the Roman Empire did, for a very brief period, conquer the city of Babylon. Now here's the only other potential empire in the history of mankind which could potentially fulfill these things. Oh, that was my joke. Do you remember that from Sesame Street? Which one of these kids is doing his own? So the point is, this is the one that's doing his own thing. When you look at the other map, oh, there it is. There's the Islamic Empire. When you look at the other maps, okay, they're all Middle Eastern, Middle Eastern, Middle Eastern, Middle Eastern. Which one of these kids is, okay, so you get the idea. Then you have the Islamic Empire. I thought I took that one out. Then you have the Islamic Empire. Now, when I say Islamic Empire, I'm referring to really a series of what are called caliphates, or khilafah in Arabic, which is essentially the Islamic government, which is military, religious, political, all wrapped under one head, pope, president, general, and a series of caliphates. Now, so right here is Mecca. This is where Muhammad, you know, Mecca and Medina, where he began the religion of Islam. After he died, very quickly they swept up through here. These are essentially the areas that Islam has come to dominate. Now today, not all of this is dominated by Islam. At one time, Spain was conquered by Islam. But this is basically the regions that Islam did come to dominate. Now, between the Roman Empire and the Islamic Empire, which one of those two meets the criteria of having crushed all the others? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. Now, the Roman Empire, you go, well, kind of. I mean, technically it conquered maybe one-third of the regions. But the Islamic Empire, there's no question. And forever, you know, if you're Nebuchadnezzar and you go, which empire is more relevant to you? The one that sort of came down for a couple months and retreated, or the one that came to crush Babylon for the past 1,400 years and absolutely spread its culture and you know, its whole belief system? Well, of course, it would be the Islamic empire over the Roman Empire. Now, again, just for clarity, you know, if you're saying modern-day Iran, which is essentially the heartland of the ancient Persian Empire, did the Roman Empire crush Persia? You know, it's supposed to crush all the others. And, you know, again, you know, they came down here. They did come down here for a short time, but really you go, it's barely relevant to the Persian Empire, to Iran. And of course, the Persian Empire actually extended all the way over here. So again, if you overlay the maps, the Roman Empire crushed about one-third of the others, but left about two-thirds of the geographic areas completely untouched. The Islamic Empire, again, obviously completely crushed, came to dominate all of those areas. Now, we've looked at the nature of the rise of the fourth kingdom. Now, let's look at the nature of its demise. This is verse 34 and 35. While you were watching, again, we read this, a rock was cut out, not by human hands. It strikes the statue on the iron and clay, the feet of iron and clay, smashes them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were broken to pieces at the same time. So when Messiah returns and crushes the kingdom of the Antichrist as represented by the feet of iron and clay, by virtue of the destruction of that empire that he will crush, that kingdom, all the others will be crushed at the same time. This is essential, that when the antichristic empire that will be revived in the last days is destroyed by Jesus, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece will all be crushed, essentially, at the same time. So once more, if the Roman Empire were fully revived today, Jesus returns, crushes that. Does Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece also get crushed? And the answer is partially. A little bit, sort of, yes, but you sort of have to finagle it to make it fit. On the other hand, if the Islamic Empire is fully revived, the Islamic Khilafah, then the kingdom of Christ comes and destroys that and establishes his kingdom, then clearly Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece are all crushed at the same time. So the Islamic Empire really clearly, overwhelmingly, easily fits the biblical criteria, the Roman Empire only with great difficulty. With great difficulty. Now here is sort of a larger global map, if you will, of the areas that have come to be dominated by Islam. And what I've done, of course, here's Israel. Now this is where Jesus comes back to establish his throne over the nations. Now what's more relevant if you understand the Israel-Jerusalem centricity of the promised plan of God, of all the scriptures, you understand that everything revolves around that geographic spot. What's more relevant, the regions that have come to be dominated by Islam or the European nations? What's more, you know, relevant if you're here in Jerusalem? What's more threatening to you? Pope Francis and his crew, or those that are many of which, not all of course, but many of which would like to see nothing more than that piece of land to be dominated by Islam, and those that live there that are Jewish to be removed. You know, of course, it's almost so glaringly obvious. You go, how could we miss it? How could we have been so focused up here on Europe? And the answer is pretty simple. It's because we're Americans. And we think the whole world revolves around us, including the biblical worldview. We think that, you know, we're the center of the earth, and therefore we should be the center of God's world. You know, like his whole worldview should just revolve around us, because we essentially trace our history through, you know, Europe, largely through the Roman Empire, our culture and laws, yada, yada. We think that that should be the center of God's, you know, attention as well. And the fact is, this is the center of God's worldview right here. And what's relevant to Jerusalem and Israel is what's relevant to the biblical narrative. Now, interestingly, when you get to verse 43, you have one of these cryptic verses. Now, of course, this section of Daniel was given to us in Aramaic. Very small portions of the Bible we have in Aramaic as opposed to Hebrew, and one of them is a section here of Daniel 2. And so some translators have had a difficulty with some of these phrases, and this one here is one of them. It's fairly cryptic. Just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay. Now it's speaking of that final empire of the Antichrist. He says, so the people will be a mixture, will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. So it's kind of a riddle where they use this word mixed three times. Now, essentially, for a little bit of history, Muhammad burst forth out of, or Islam burst forth out of Arabia and very quickly conquered much of the Middle East. But essentially, in many ways, Islam was an Arab supremacist program. It was exporting Arab religion, Arab language, Arab culture throughout the Middle East. What do they speak today in Iraq? They speak Arabic. What do they speak in Lebanon? They speak Arabic. You know, this was not their ancient language. They were speaking essentially Aramaic when Islam or Syriac came forward. Now, it's not the case in Persia, in Iran today, or in Turkey, is it? So while there was this effort to Arabize the much of the world, you know, or you get, you know, some guy in North Africa, and there's this, you know, demand that he's supposed to name his child, you know, Muhammad, you know, Abdul Malik or something. Well, what's that? That's an Arabic name. Why is there pressure that he can't name his child an African name? It's because there is a very strong Arab supremacist spirit within Islam. And, you know, again, ask anybody from an Islamic-dominated section of Africa, or really any other place that Islam has come to dominate. So you had this program to essentially Arabize the region, but it was not entirely successful. Even as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, the people will be a mixture, will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. Well, here's what's so interesting, is the word there in Aramaic for mixed is Arab. It's one and the same. So if you're just reading it in the original language, the word says, even as, you know, iron Arabizes with clay, or cannot Arabize with clay, so to speak, the people will be Arab. I mean, this is just what it says in the original language. And of course, Aramaic, fairly similar to Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's Ereb, and even in modern day, you know, Arabic, a car is an Araba. You know, it's like a blender that spins around, it goes around. That's Arab, Araba. It's the mixing or the blending. And essentially, throughout the scriptures, by the way, the whole purpose of the Lord was to call out a separate people, that they would be wholly set aside for him, and they were not to mix with the pagans, to mix with the world. And so the Lord says to, you know, Esau, don't intermarry with the Ishmaelites. Is it because God's opposed to, you know, interracial marriage? No, it's because he's opposed to interpagan marriage. You know, he says, look, don't intermix with the pagans, because if you do, they'll mislead you to follow other gods. This was the whole point. He says, I want you to be a separate people, a holy people set aside for me. Don't mix with the world. And then, of course, they did, Esau, Ishmael, and the pagans of the desert, and they became known as the Arabs, the mixed ones. That's the etymology, that's the history of the word, biblically speaking, or just historically speaking. So essentially what you have is an Aramaic wordplay, just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be Arab, will not remain united. And again, I want to be clear, this is not a slam on Arab people, it's just pointing to the primary ethnicity of the empire. In the history of this whole world is empires. It's only until just recently that empire becomes sort of a foreign concept. The history of mankind is one of this empire rises here, this one rises here. You spread out to try to essentially get revenue streams. You know, you conquer people to get taxes and so forth. And it's very similar to another story in the book of Daniel, where you have the story of the finger and the handwriting on the wall. And Belshazzar, the son, I think he was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, I believe, he's getting drunk, he's drinking out of the temple utensils that they had stolen from the Hebrews, and all of a sudden this finger appears and it says, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, paras," or Perez. And then Daniel comes again, the interpreter, and he gives the interpretation. And when he gets to the word Perez, which means divided, he does a little word play, and he says, you know, basically in Semitic languages, Perez and Paras rhyme. It's not like our rhyme, you know, car or, you know, fat, rat, bat, cat. You know, we have like some real strict rules about rhymes. This is a rhyme in Semitic language. So Perez, and then, which means divided. Daniel says, your kingdom will be divided and it will be given to the Paras. So it was sort of a divine riddle that Daniel untangled. And it's really very similar. Daniel says, the kingdom, the ethnicity of the people that are about to conquer you will be the Paras, the Persians. And then here's, you know, this other one where he says, the people, that final kingdom will be Arab. It will be an Arab kingdom. Then you have the issue that the kingdom will be divided. Daniel 2, verse 41. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. This is a defining characteristic of the fourth kingdom, of the final antichristic kingdom. It will be divided. So now you look at the Roman Empire, and you say, well, people go, well, yeah, you had the Eastern and the Western Roman Empire. Yeah, for, you know, about 150 years or so of that 1500 years that the Roman Empire existed, there's a brief period where you could say it was divided, but it really doesn't define the overwhelming existence of the Roman Empire. On the other hand, the Islamic Empire, from the very beginning after Muhammad died, you had the dispute that arose among his followers and those that were called his companions or the Sahaba. They thought that his friends, his disciples essentially, should be his successors, and they became known as the Sunnis. And they are the majority sect of Islam today, as represented by those areas in green. That's where you have Sunni Islam dominates. And then those that believe that the successorship of Muhammad should go to his family, they became known as the Shia. That's the party of Ali, the Shia Ali. And that's the minority sect, which is about 13-15% of the Islamic world, primarily in Iran, a bit in Iraq, up in Azerbaijan, as well as Lebanon, where that's where the majority of the Shia are today. But from the very, very beginning, after Muhammad died, it was a divided kingdom, and it is till this very day. If you pay attention to the news, the war in Iraq, anywhere, the phrase that the news uses is sectarian violence. We had sectarian violence in Iraq, which is basically Sunnis killing Shia, Shia killing Sunnis. And that has defined Islam throughout its history. It really has. And here you have proof that even at the end of the age, the armies of the Antichrist are in the land of Israel at that final hour, gathered together, and even at that last hour, they're killing each other. Ezekiel 38, verse 21, I will call for a sword against him on all my mountains, declares the Lord. So here's the armies of Gog, the Antichrist, in Israel. Every man's sword will be against his brother. They're killing each other in the land. Frequently, Shia, you know, maybe the radical, the Ayatollahs, the regime in Iran, they'd be willing to even fund and support Al-Qaeda, although Al-Qaeda is Sunni, and normally they would be conflicted. But if it's for the purpose of defeating Israel, they're willing to come together. The enemy of my enemy is my friend idea. Zechariah 14, verse 13, on that day, men will be stricken by the Lord with great panic. Each man will seize the hand of another, and they will attack each other. Speaking again of the armies of the Antichrist in the land. So that is a characteristic of that final antichristic empire right up until the very end. And of course, we know the ancient biblical origins of this entire conflict go right back to the beginning of the scriptures. Genesis 16, 11 through 12, this is the story of Hagar. And of course, if you remember, Hagar bore Ishmael to Abraham, and then the Lord says, Abraham, you were supposed to listen to me. I promised you that I was going to give you a child. You took it into your own hands. You went and had a child with Hagar. You have to kick her out of the camp. And so she's distraught, and the angel of the Lord comes to Hagar, and he says to her, you are now with child, you'll have a son, you'll call his name Ishmael, which means the Lord hears. Okay, and I believe, by the way, and we'll discuss this, I believe that the prayer of the church needs to be, Father, in these days, hear the cry of Ishmael. Throughout the earth, you have Muslims that five times a day, they're bowing to Mecca. They are diligently, zealously praying. And you say, Father, do for them what you've done for us. Open their eyes to your beauty and your goodness, that they would become followers of you, that you would give them the grace that you've given me, that you've given us, right? This needs to be our attitude. This isn't about seeing enemies or seeing people to be afraid of. It's not the point. And again, you know, in looking at this, this cannot be emphasized enough. Our attitude needs to be one of humility and brokenness and say, Lord, they have been so ripped off. Why? Because they work way harder than I do, and yet you don't show up, you don't give them anything, and at the end of their life, they're cast into a lake of fire. And you say, why is it that your grace has come to me? Father, do for them what you've done for us. We'll talk about that a lot more tomorrow. But so, you shall name him Ishmael. I really believe that is a prophetic declaration over the Islamic world. And then he says, for the Lord has heard your misery. He says that to Hagar. And then he says this, he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. He will live in hostility toward all his brothers. Okay? That phrase defines the Middle East for the past 1,400 years. All of Islam's borders are bloody, and so are all of its insides. That's a statement made by Samuel Huntington. And, you know, it's not always true. I'm not trying to say that all Muslims are just bloodthirsty, whatever, but just that over that general statement, he will be a wild donkey of a man, which can seem offensive. By the way, I openly confess that I'm a wild donkey of a man. I mean, not, you know, unbridled, but, you know, the Lord has made me a bit of a wild donkey, constantly struggling to submit myself to his yoke. But what happens is when Muslims always look at this verse, they go, the Jews perverted the scriptures, and they put that slam, that little, you know, they put that in there. They corrupted the scriptures, you know. And but the truth is, just look at the Islamic world, you know. Just kind of show some humility and admit the fact that your hand has been against your brothers from the beginning, and it's clear for all to see. Now, the problem with the Roman view again is its failure to crush. So what most commentators do is they go, well, the Roman Empire, I want to come back to this issue of crushing. They go, they had some harsh military men. If there was an uprising, they crushed it, you know, and they'll go, that really, the iron, that fulfills the Roman Empire to a T. Well, the problem is, I believe that this reference to crushing is more than mere military brutality of uprisings or rebellions. I believe it's speaking of conquering geographically, that's just borders, but also culturally, religiously, linguistically, all of the above. And so this reference is repeated in Daniel chapter 7, which is really a reiteration of Daniel 2. It's telling the same story, but it's using very different language. And here it says of the fourth kingdom, which is now used, there's a beast that it's using to describe that. It says, after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening, very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims, and then it tramples underfoot whatever is left. Look at Syria today. Antioch is actually in Turkey. This was once the heart of the ancient Christian world. Okay, and then comes Islam. And we'll talk about what Islam did when it swept through that area in the early conquests. And today, what was once the heart of the ancient Christian church is a struggling minority. Okay, it's devoured with its teeth. And then what's happening today is the residue is being trampled underfoot. You know, even just the minority that's left gets trampled. And through the combination of persecution, the combination of when Islamic law is implemented, what's called the jizya tax that Islam imposes on the conquered peoples, and that economic pressure, and the pressure to convert, and all of these things, it is the ongoing grinding and crushing that Islam has affected on the church throughout the past 1,400 years. Now, the Roman Empire, when we look at history, it's known not so much for being that grinding, crushing, destroying empire. Rather, it's known specifically for adding infrastructure, for adding law, for adding order, roads, aqueducts. These are the things that the Roman Empire is known for. It was an ancient nation-building empire, not a crushing empire. It allowed its conquered subjects to maintain their religion, their language, their culture, all of these things. Now, In all fairness, there was some stiff taxes that they imposed on their peoples that they conquered. And this is the nature of empire. And they, you know, tip the hat to Caesar, hail Caesar, and give us your taxes. But other than that, as long as they submitted to those strictures, they were allowed, again, to maintain their language, their religion, their culture. And in fact, the reality is, by the way, that much of the Roman Empire, rather than crushing all these other cultures, was actually itself dominated by Greek culture, rather than being this sort of cultural imperialism. It itself was dominated by the Greek culture that preceded it. During the New Testament times, Herod's temple prospered, right? And they were proud. Look how tolerant we are. You know, we allow the Jews to have all their rituals and so forth. This was the name. They were a relatively tolerant empire in terms of ancient empires. On the other hand, Islam. It's the crushing empire. It crushed, it devoured its victims. We've just looked at that. Now, here is a map which portrays the expansion of Islam after Muhammad died. So, here is the Arabian Peninsula. Again, Muhammad begins down here, Mecca and Medina. This black area is the area that he conquered during the 23 years of his career. Is it 23? Well, the time of his expansion, 22. So, really, all of, and he, by the way, he removed, when he was done, he had kicked out every single Jew out of the entire Arabian Peninsula. Now, after he died, from 632, so less than 30 years after he died, Islam had conquered all of this area of Egypt, much of Libya, just reached over to Tunisia, I mean Syria, Iraq, most of Iran, a good part of Asia Minor, up into Azerbaijan, Armenia, you know, this whole area in 30 years. This was the ancient heart of the Christian church. You had Alexandria over here, Tripoli and Carthage, Antioch, Antakya, Jerusalem, and then, of course, you know, Ephesus and the seven churches. And actually, Islam did conquer the shoreline, like they came along those and did conquer the ancient seven churches of the book of Revelation. But I mean, that is an incredible, in 30 quick years, they crushed the heart of the ancient Christian church. And then in the time that followed, the rest of North Africa up into Spain, I mean, you know, Cordoba and all the way. I mean, it was an incredible thing. And eventually, of course, with after the Turks, you know, all of Asia Minor, up here into Macedonia, all the way actually into Ukraine. The Crimea at one time was under the Ottoman Empire that's in the news right now. Here are the early Muslim conquests. Within 4 years, 250,000 Christians were killed after Muhammad died. Okay, in ancient times, that was a huge number. The next 10 years, over 1 million Christians were killed. And this is thoroughly attested to. I want to be clear. This is not just historical revisionism. This is according to the earliest Muslim sources, At-Tabari and the various Islamic scholars that recorded these events, as well as the Christian documents. And this is, you know, scholarly historical sources. They would besiege a city. They would kill all the resistors. They would distribute the booty. Okay, this was essentially an ancient pirate movement. It was much of the motivation to join the conquest because you got your share of the booty. They would march 30 to 50,000 women back to Mecca as slaves. Think of the effects of that on a family, you know, trying to live a Christian life, and suddenly this thing comes out of nowhere in just a brief time. In less than one generation, the ancient heart of Christendom was crushed. Within 100 years, 50% of global Christianity had completely come under Islamic subjugation. So just some modern examples. This is in Afghanistan. You had the Buddhists. Now, you know, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Buddha. I'm not a Buddhist. I don't do Buddha. I don't do Voodoo. And, you know, granted, I'm not into idols, but, I mean, these guys did, sorry, let me go back. They did carve the thing out of rock. I mean, you got to give them some credit. And the Taliban came along, and they used dynamite to rid the idols, you know. So this was just this, like, incredible tourist attraction for the poor people of Afghanistan. The Taliban said, no idols. This is the nature of Islam. they come along and crush, devour, erase. This is the Hagia Sophia, the what was once the largest ancient church, you know, in the ancient world. The stories about the church are just incredible in terms of the people that were there during the time when the church was in its full splendor. We were just there this summer. And then, of course, in 1453, Mehmet the Conqueror comes. Islam finally conquers Constantinople. And this is what was once the world's largest church today. It's a mosque, which is actually a museum. They say it's a museum, but if you're a Christian, don't pray in the museum. If you're Muslim, no problem. Okay, so you know, if they even catch you like praying or whatever, you'll get kind of kicked out by the security guards. But Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey right now, is actually trying to turn it back into a mosque. Now here is what they did, and I just want to highlight this. This is the nature of Islam. That's in Arabic, that's Allah, the name of the God of the Quran. And essentially what they did is they come in, and what they're very deliberate in removing the symbols, the elements that speak of Christianity. Now, you go, well, wait a minute, there's Mary. Well, Islam, the Quran affirms that Jesus was born of a virgin. So they still maintain that. So that's allowed to stay. But they just kind of come in, and I can't help, whenever I see this, and I've been here a few times, they get these, like this plaque right here, it's probably about 20 feet across. It's huge. It's just this giant plaque. But it's like they just kind of come in and bloop, 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 Muhammad, Allah, Ali, you know, and they just kind of put them up there. And it's the usurping, it's sort of the brazen usurping nature of it that I couldn't help think of this, which I got from a movie that I won't tell you because you shouldn't see the movie. But it's kind of like this. This is me without a beard. Now, is that right to do? Does this mean that this is my family? No, I just stuck my face right there. Like, that doesn't count. Well, that doesn't count either. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is the nature of Islam. It's just like, we took over. It's ours now. This is our family. You're gone. It was Talladega Nights. Here is Albania. This was under George Bush. They gave, actually it's Kosovo, which was the ancient heart of Serbia, which was given over to Albania. Now, of course, Albania is said to be, you know, very moderate Muslims. Well, here was this beautiful Greek Orthodox, or I guess, I don't know, Eastern Orthodox Church, Serbian Orthodox. And the first thing they do, I don't know if you can see that, is they're ripping the crosses off the top. And there's another big cross. The church is on fire. They're kind of grainy. This is from a video. But the first thing they do is rip the crosses off. And there's the church after the very moderate Muslims of Albania got to it. Now, you know, across the nation, since this has taken place, again, I want to be clear, under Bush, hundreds of churches have been demolished. Some of these Orthodox monks have to be escorted around in armored vehicles. Here's a little monastery, you know, out in the woods where you go and pray all the time. And, you know, again, I'm not Orthodox, but with five kids, that's appealing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just going to go be a monk for a while and just give myself to the Lord. I'm just going to commune. And then, of course, after the moderate Muslims got to it. And again, hundreds of monasteries and churches in just the past, I don't know, maybe about 15 years or maybe less, maybe about 10 years since we did that again under Bush. So in conclusion, I would say that the fourth kingdom of Daniel 2 is the Islamic Caliphate or the Islamic Empire. The Roman Empire doesn't fit. Everything culturally, historically about the Islamic Empire does. So here's the statue. I would submit to you that the kingdoms spoken of are Babylon, the head of gold, Medo-Persia, Greece. After that is the Islamic Caliphate. This is the next kingdom that came in succession of the others and crushed Babylon. That you go, well, historically the Roman Empire, you know, yes, there is a gap, historical gap right here. And people say, well, you can't do that. It's one continuous thing. But the problem is, even those that say it's the Roman Empire, they put like a 1,500-year gap right here. So every position has a gap somewhere. I would argue that this empire fulfills the descriptions according to the scriptures much better than anything else in history. And then we're told that at the end of time, this, we're not looking at all the scriptures, but this would suffer essentially a fatal head wound spoken of in Revelation 13, and it would be revived. That the feet represent the final manifestation of that Islamic empire. The point is that the historical Islamic empire that existed for about 1,300 years, which was officially abolished in 1923 by Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, this was the founder of the modern-day Republic of Turkey, where the leadership, the caliph, that's the again the leader of the caliphate, was set at the time. He abolished that office and he abolished this empire. And then the Western colonizing powers came in and sort of arbitrarily broke the Middle East up, that thing which fell apart in 1923 is in the process of being revived. And in the days ahead, we will see that regional empire, an Islamic union, whatever we call it, whatever it's called, it doesn't matter. We will see the reunification of that section of the world under the leadership of some form of, you know, caliphate, a caliph, an Islamic religious, political, and military ruler, and then it's in the time of this empire that the kingdom of Messiah comes and crushes this, and when he does so, all of the others will be crushed at the same time. So there's a map in modern terms, again, of the nations that are most heavily dominated by Islam, and so you can understand where the heart of even persecution will be in the days ahead. And just really where it's all going. So I'll end it with that. Let me pray briefly. It's 8:35. I don't know if we want to take a few minutes for some questions or whatnot, but I understand that was a very long session. But let me just pray, and we'll take some questions. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you that that you're opening these things up and you're making them clear to your church. Now, Lord, what we want more than anything is the ability to properly apply this information. We don't want to use it to be fearful or to be hateful or to be angry. We want to use it to spur us on to serve you more diligently in the days ahead, that we would use this information to understand where we are in the earth, what time it is, what we should be doing, what we should be giving ourselves to, how we should be expelling our time, our energy, our money, our resources, our prayers, the missionaries that we should be giving ourselves to support, the areas of the world that we should be crying out for. Lord, we ask that you would wake us up this weekend and that you would help us to be alert, that you would help us to be awake, that we would be alert ones in the earth, and that we would maximize the time that we have, and that we would tremble before you because the day of the Lord draws near, and at the same time we would rejoice before you because you've called us and you've made us your own. We thank you for your goodness to us and for all the things that you've poured out on us, the grace that you've given us undeservedly. We thank you. In the name of Jesus, amen.